Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Danielle Del Sol, whose new book is Painting the Town: The Importance of Color in Historic New Orleans Architecture. Love to have Danielle Del Sol as a guest on The Reading Life because that means we're about to unveil another beautiful book from the Preservation Resource Center of New Orleans. Danielle is executive director of the center, and she's here to talk about the gorgeous new volume, Painting the Town, The Importance of Color in Historic New Orleans Architecture. Danielle, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
This book is electric to look at. It's so bright and beautiful, everything. But what I love most, well, I don't love it most, but what I love a lot is that you start with the very question of what is paint exactly?
Yes. We are so accustomed in modern day to going to our favorite paint store and having literally an infinite rainbow of colors and shades to choose from. And that is very modern.
Right.
And, you know, when New Orleans was founded in the early 1700s, and as settlers came and built buildings here and began putting up what we would call today as paint, there were very few options, and yet they figured out a way to make them colorful. The city has been colorful from the start. And so that is the question that really inspired this book is, we know from the notarial archives and watercolors from the early 1800s that this was always a vibrant city. So how did that come to be, and why has that carried through to modern day?
Well, and it's fascinating to see the raw materials there on the page.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Wow, it's amazing. And it's fun that you include so many colors that are specifically New Orleans colors.
Mm-hmm. It really is a gift that we have this palette for the Vue Carré that, you know, was not just inspired but informed by historical colors of that neighborhood. So the Vue Carré Commission is the only entity that regulates colors in the city. And if you own a property in the French Quarter, they have a say over what color you paint your property. And they have a very specific list of colors that are approved. And that's because they are historically informed. And so it's actually, you know, while that is burdensome to some property owners, and it really is a gift that we have this knowledge of what original colors were in this city.
Talk about the color black, for example. The Vue Carré.
Yeah, I mean, it's very popular now. These kind of neutral norms are very popular. Beiges, whites, blacks. And when I talk to the people who work at the Vue Carré and I ask them, what would be the color, if you guys could, you know, if the rules went away, what colors would homes be in the French Quarter? And their answer was beige. People would use beige and black for everything.
Wow.
Can you imagine that?
No.
Can you imagine a French Quarter that was all beige and black? So I personally am very grateful for, you know, this governing authority that keeps things authentic in the French Quarter. You know, we have very close to black French Quarter green. When you paint it on, it really does kind of look black. And then as it patinas, you see it is a very dark green. That's as close as they'll allow.
And another color that doesn't always work out the way you think it will is red.
It's true. Red can take on all sorts of iterations depending on the time of day, cloud cover. And so reds can look very pink or they can look very rusty. You know, one thing that's so wonderful about our book and the photography by Chris Granger is that he captures all those iterations. We really show so many variations of how red can turn out in the book.
And also he captures so many perfect little pieces of architecture.
Yes, he does. He notices things that I have driven by a million times without noticing.
And he makes it so beautiful. He's got that eye. He really does. Now, you have several essays by John Pope, who is a writer so many people love from the Times-Picayune and now from books like these. So talk about some of the things he's chosen to write.
John Pope's writing is so delightful, and that really shines in this book. So why is Commander's Palace this vibrant turquoise blue? He really explores that with such a fun essay. Same with Brennan's. Why is Brennan's this pink? And
right.
You will be delighted to see the pink color names are food related as well. Literally, I believe it's tomato soup with creme is the pink of the outside of Brennan's. And then in a more serious essay, he actually explains that a lot of the Creole tombs were originally colorful. So when we think of our cemeteries, yes, we think of our raised tombs, but we think of them all as white. And actually, a lot of them were painted, these kind of earthy reds and browns and yellows. And that is fascinating to me. I never knew that.
I think I would just love to see what that looked like.
I know. I wish you could go back in time for a peek.
And then, of course, one of the most famous colors of all, K&B purple.
Of course. Yes. So how did that come to be? And there's no one agreed upon answer to that. And so John goes into that in his essay about K&B purple. But one thing that is true that he does share in the book is that because of K&B's advertisements, the Times-Picayune bought more purple ink than any other newspaper in the country, which I think is so fun.
That's a fun fact too. And now, for the first time, maybe, I think, this great New Orleans character finally gets his due in a book, and that is Louis Aubert.
Oh, yes.
Talk a little bit about him. I love him. He has one of the best jobs in town.
He sure does.
And he does it so well.
He sure does. Louis is respected by everyone as the color expert. So if you have a historic structure and you want a new paint palette, you want to inside or outside, Louis knows. And he does an amazing job of balancing all the factors to pick the paint colors with you. He looks at your streetscape if you're picking an exterior color. He looks at what the other colors are on the street. He looks at your landscaping and what colors you have in the foliage around your house. But then he also considers when your home was built and what was the norm of that time. You know, was it a Victorian? Is it arts and crafts? What was that architectural style typically painted as? And so he's not going to tell you, you know, you have a Victorian house, you have to choose one of these three colors. He's going to work with you to pick what you want in this modern day. But he just does such a brilliant job of bringing all those factors together with just fabulous wit and the funniest stories. And so it was a real joy to work with him on this book.
He needs to write his memoirs.
He sure does.
I really, really do. And I love that he's included a color palette in this book.
Yes. We wanted this book to be inspiring, but also practical. And the thing about walking into your favorite local paint store is that it can be overwhelming, completely overwhelming to have thousands of colors to choose from. And so we wanted Louis to bring some of his favorites, just a very simple list of his favorites, so that if you don't have an artistic sense or a design sensibility and you want a very easy list to just choose a few colors, we've got it for you.
I know. That was really handy. Thank you very much. Now, Painting the Town is such a festive title.
It is.
But there are some dark undercurrents to that idea. So,
well, that's the other practical element of this book, is being a preservation organization. We know that so many houses, you might even say the majority of historic houses, if they haven't been updated in the past 10, 20 years, have lead paint in them. And this is a dangerous reality. It was just so common for paint to be made with lead for so many years. And the reality is that we have high lead levels amongst our population in part because of this.
Right.
The lead paint flakes off. You don't have to sit there and eat a piece of the paint for it to be ingested by your body for you to breathe it in and be affected by you. So, you know, we really care a lot about helping people with lead paint remediation. And so there is a part in the book that talks about how you go about doing that, how you test for lead paint, and why it's important to update literally the paint in your home to avoid this sort of toxin.
Oh, it's so important. Once you've been through that process, it's really terrifying.
Yes, absolutely.
And you also offer some solutions to the mystery of why people paint their porch ceilings blue.
Yes, absolutely. So again, this is another one where there are different theories as to why. We have heard many times that this tradition comes originally from Africa and then came through the Gullah Geechee people of coastal South Carolina and made its way across the South, where it was believed that spirits or haints would be warded off if you painted your porch the color of the sky. And they could just keep going up. And instead of going into your home, they just keep going up towards the sky. And so that is why the paint color is known colloquially as haint blue. It is also believed, and this is widely accepted, that many bugs will not build nests on your porch ceiling because they can't distinguish between that shade of blue on your porch and the sky. So I don't know if that's true, but a lot of us believe that that is also a reason that this was is so widespread throughout the South and particularly in New Orleans.
Why not?
Absolutely. It's so pleasing to the eye. One thing we realized when writing this book and doing this research is that there's no one porch ceiling blue. If you look, for example, at the Benjamin Moore palette of blues. And so Helm Paint is actually a sponsor of this book, and they were an amazing resource throughout the process because Benjamin Moore, as a company, has really devoted a lot of effort towards historical paint colors. And so what Helm Paint locally does is they have their own version. It's not on any of the little cards. It's not an official color in the Benjamin Moore palette, but Helm Paint has developed its own New Orleans porch ceiling blue. And so if you go in there and ask for that, they know exactly what to give you, and it is spot on perfect.
And they are always right.
They know exactly what they're doing.
The last time I was there was getting paint for a little free library, so they were very, very helpful.
That's great.
Now, I have to ask, there are some houses that you went into a little more detail than others. Mm-hmm. Talk about choosing those and why you selected those.
Well, a lot of the pictures in this book are quote unquote anonymous. You might see the photo and you might know exactly where the house is.
Yeah.
But we were very intentional about A, trying to get photos from neighborhoods across the city, and B, not identifying where those homes are, with the idea of being, you could be in any part of New Orleans and have a really vibrant, colorful experience. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the book is anonymous as to where the photographs were taken. But we did single out a few properties to really go into detail about because we knew who picked the colors and the stories behind them. And one of those buildings is Gallier Hall. And so Louis Aubert worked with Cheryl Landrieu, the First Lady of New Orleans at the time, and others on that building's magnificent restoration. And he was very intentional about picking the interior colors of the building, and they are so vibrant. And we really hope that that comes through in the book. It is a stately white Greek Revival building, and so you might think that it would be, you know, just as kind of clean on the inside, but it is not. It really knocks you out with reds and greens in the building. And so Louis goes into detail in the book about why he chose those particular colors. And it's already been a few years now since the renovation, but we just had the photos taken right before publication, and they really have stood up the past few years. They are beautiful.
And I, of course, love the Beauregard Kyes house.
Absolutely. And that, you know, so many people remember that house as being yellow.
Yes.
And so we you know, really worked with Anne Masson, talking with her about why they chose to go to a white, which it originally was. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of a controversial move for them because people just associate that building with yellow, but that originally was the color of the building. And so they were very confident in taking it back. But people get emotionally attached to color in this city. And that's one thing that we hear a lot at the PRC is when someone paints their building, even if it's just a private home and somebody doesn't like it, they'll call us to complain.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about the color white.
The color white is something that really came into the city with the movement of Americans moving to the city in the early 1800s, you know, after the Louisiana Purchase, a wave of Americans, Protestants from the North came down to the region. And, you know, the book really goes into, in the fabulous essay by Michelle Duhon, a local historian and preservation practitioner, it really goes into the religious and cultural background of color and why this was such an originally colorful city. And a lot of that has to do with the settlers, you know, the French and the Spanish colonial settlers, their Catholic backgrounds and their European backgrounds, and also the enslaved people who came from Africa and them having this amazing background of use of color as well, and all of that coming together. Well, when the Protestants came in, the belief of white symbolizing purity and cleanliness and order, that took over. And so there has been this prevalence of white in our city, and a lot of it is attached to certain historical styles. So Greek Revival styles really embraces the white, and you might have a pop of color in the shutter, perhaps. But that is very common, and you'll see it more in certain neighborhoods. We did notice that as we went around town, there were more vibrant colors in the downtown neighborhoods, Marigny, Bywater, Treme. When you go uptown, you will see more whites and beiges and grays. That just is. And that has been for a long time. But it's also cyclical, too. So there have been periods of time when white was more popular and everybody was painting their house white with green shutters, you know. And so we are in a moment here. And Amazon actually said this beautifully to us. This captures a moment in time. This is New Orleans in 2023, 2024. And in this moment in time, we are really embracing color citywide again. And it ebbs and flows. But at this moment, we've got a lot going on.
I'm glad we're here to see this
moment.
Me too. It's really special. Now, this was a huge team effort of people working on this book.
Absolutely.
So talk a little bit about some of the contributors.
Yes. So it's edited by our incredibly talented communications director at the PRC, Susan Langenhennig. And she has, you know, a storied background in the city with journalism. And she has edited our past books as well, Building on the Past and The Cottage on Chapultepec. So we were very lucky to have her at the helm editing the book and doing a lot of the writing as well. As you mentioned, John Pope is a contributor. Chris Granger, the award-winning photojournalist, he's just unbelievable. And this book is a testament to his talent. I mean, the vibrancy on each page is because he is such a talented
his versatility.
Photographer.
He'll do anything to get the right picture.
Anything. He'll lean out of windows. He'll climb on trash cans. He'll do anything. And he really has an amazing eye, too, for the kind of grittiness of our city at times. So there was a big debate with Chris and Susan and Liz, our designer, about some of these photos have trash cans in them. They have electrical wires. You know, a lot of these buildings, the paint is peeling off. We didn't want to portray New Orleans as anything other than it is. We're not going to make this photoshopped perfect. We want it to be real. And so a lot of these photos still have the kind of quote unquote uglier things that you might not want in a photograph, but we left them because this is truly true to our city. So Chris was really great about being authentic in that way. Michelle Duhon, as I mentioned, wrote the intro that really sets the scene for the book of why we are such historically a colorful place. Sally Reeves was the keeper of the notarial archives for decades.
And so much knowledge about New Orleans
so
in
much
general.
Incredible, deep knowledge of our roots as a city developing in those early years. And so she writes about the notarial archives and the holdings, which those watercolors that are housed there are, A, truly unique in the world. We are very lucky to have a record like we have in New Orleans. We don't know any other place that has these sorts of real estate records from our earliest days. And B, that is our proof that we were historically a colorful city, is those very well-preserved watercolors. So that is a wonderful essay in there as well. And then I have to give a shout out to our designer, Liz Jury, who did a beautiful job putting Chris's photos together because he literally turned in thousands of photos for us to choose from, and talk about an overwhelming task. But she does a beautiful job juxtaposing architectural photos with photos of our culture and our life. So she will put a photo of a house next to a row of snowball syrups in all different colors. And you see how the two play together.
And you see the red crawfish.
You see the red crawfish. Yes, absolutely. Or the orange and brown leaves surrounding the street tiles and then juxtaposed with an orange home. And so she did a beautiful job of putting everything together and designing the book to be just really spectacular.
Oh, it is. We've been talking with Danielle Del Sol, the Preservation Resource Center, about their gorgeous new book, Painting the Town, The Importance of Color in Historic New Orleans Architecture. Danielle, thank you so much.
Oh, such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Last but a no coat of paint on his lonesome old town. Set him up, we'll be knocking him down.
It's festival season here in Louisiana, and we're getting ready for the next literary gathering, Words and Music, A Literary Feast of New Orleans, which is coming up November 20th through 23rd at the André Cailloux Center on Bayou Road. This year has a lot of action with something for everyone. Welcome to Executive Director Megan Holt to give us a preview. Megan, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me back, Susan.
This is a big anniversary year. It is. It is. One Book, One New Orleans, which, as you know, hosts Words and Music, is 20 years old this year. We were founded in 2004 as a project of the YLC, and we're a YLC project for many years before spinning off into a nonprofit.
Now, the festival opens Wednesday night, November 20th, with a tribute to a very special New Orleanian teacher, performer, writer, activist, Kalamu Ya Salaam. So that's going to be something to really look forward to. So talk about honoring him in this particular way.
This tribute is the labor of Kelly Harris DeBerry, who is curating this event. She has worked tirelessly to bring about an event that will hopefully do his career justice. So thank you so much, Kelly, for everything that you have done. And for me personally, this feels long overdue because, as you know, in 2020, New Orleans Griot, the Tom Dent Reader, was the One Book, One New Orleans selection.
Right.
And we, at the beginning of that year, had talked about doing something toward the end of that calendar year to really honor Baba Kalamu, who edited the Tom Dent Reader. But as you know, the end of 2020 was not a thing. So for me, this tribute is 4 years overdue. And it will feature people from throughout his career, folks from Students at the Center, which he was instrumental in founding, the NOMO Writers Group, folks who have worked with him at Renegade Press, folks who have worked with him at UNO Press, and a host of others.
He's done it all.
He really has. And he also just published his first novel, so he's still doing it all.
Now, one of the things you've done so brilliantly with this festival is maintain this focus on social justice, which has been such an important theme. And there'll be one session, Public Reflections on Captive State, Louisiana, and the Making of Mass Incarceration. So talk a little bit about that and the larger issue.
Right. So that is on Friday, November 22nd at 6 o'clock p.m. And it is the brainchild of current Louisiana Poet Laureate Allison Pellegrin. Allison and the Historic New Orleans Collection were talking about ways to involve the HNOC's current exhibit, which is called Captive State, Louisiana and the Making of Mass Incarceration, into her Poet Laureate work, getting workshops into penitentiaries. They knew that Words and Music had this kind of social justice bent, so they approached us about co-curating an event where local poets compose pieces in response to that exhibit, and those will be debuted at Words and Music. And let me tell you, it is a powerhouse lineup. We've got Allison Pellegrin, of course, Kelly Harris DeBerry, Charisma Price, Christopher Louis Romaguera, Mona Lisa Saloy, Chicandria Icon Sibley, Stacey Balkin, Guillaume Francisco Smith, and Jessica Kennison.
One of the things that's always fascinated me about Louisiana is how many writing families there are here, like the Dubuque Burke clan, you know, tons and tons of families, the Ambroses, for example.
Yes, yes.
And you're highlighting that with the Cooleys.
Yes.
And with the Batiste. So talk about that family gathering, which will probably rock.
Yes. So on Thursday at 5 o'clock p.m., November 21st, it's called It's a Family Affair. Yes, we're riffing off Sly and the Family Stone there, because how can you not?
No.
Right?
We've been talking about Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, with Executive Director Megan Holt. Get on out there November 20th through 23rd. Thanks so much for coming over, Megan.
Thank you always for having me, Susan. It's a pleasure.
On tap in the literary life this week. Vanessa Saunders signs The Flat Woman and appears in conversation with Anel Lopez Friday, November 15th at 6:30 at Vino Fine Wine and Spirits on Oak Street. This is a ticketed event. Ta-Nehisi Coates and Joyanne Reed present an evening of conversation on empathy, power, and progress. Friday, November 15th at 7 at the Xavier Convocation Center, presented by Baldwin & Company. Two local authors, Adrian Van Young and Elise Speranza, will be the featured speakers at the November Saturday Writers Clinic. beginning at 9:30 Saturday, November 16th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Adrian Van Young will discuss how to craft a tense scene to generate suspense, starting at 9:30, followed by Elise Baranza at 11, who will discuss book publicity. This event is free of charge and open to the public with no registration. The Garden District Bookshop hosts Tom Colicchio, whose new book is Why I Cook, in conversation with Chef Emeril Lagasse, Saturday, November 16th at 2 at Le Petit Theatre du Vieux-Carré. This is a ticketed event. Friends of the New Orleans Public Library will hold the Really, Really Big Book Sale Saturday, November 16th on the lawn of Ladder Library. Hours are members only 10 to 11, public hours 11 to 3. Please bring bags and boxes for your purchases. Rodney Jones, Roger Kamenetz, and Justin Hamm present a poetry reading Sunday, November 17th at 6 at the Domino on St. Claude Avenue. T.Q. Sims discusses and signs the second part of the Lovers in Arms series, Monday, November 18th at 6:30. This is a ticketed event presented by Blue Cypress Books. Jeanette Weiland signs her new book, Alligator Stew, illustrated by her mother, Roberta Van Zant Laughlin. Wednesday, November 20th from 5 to 7 at Dickie Brennan's Acorn Cafe. That's in the Louisiana Children's Museum in City Park. Chris Champagne discusses and signs Secret Louisiana, Monday, November 18th at 6 at Octavia Books. And mark your calendar for the Words and Music Literary Festival presented by One Book, One New Orleans. It's coming up November 20th through 23rd at the Andre Caillou Center on Bayou Road. Check out the schedule now at wordsandmusic.org. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.